been sold the idea that financial independence is all about some number on your account statement, or even worse, that you don't qualify because of where you started out. That's just not true. It's not about some well-kept secret of the wealthy. It's about finding the right information and knowing how to apply it. On the Get Ready for the Future show, we're answering your questions so you can start making real financial change today. The journey to true financial independence begins right here, and it starts with you.
It's what drives us, helping people to discover, protect, and share true financial independence. It's why we exist at Genwell Financial Advisors, and it is why this show is on the air, and welcome to it. It is the Get Ready for the Future show. My name is Scott Inman, along with Janet Walker. Settle in, answering your questions today on the show, as we always do. And if you have one for us, we want to invite you right away, right off the top, to get it to us by calling or texting it in to 501-381-5228. You can either leave a voicemail. We've got one of those for you today. You can send it in text form, or you can send it in an email form. Just send it to the address show@getreadyforthefuture.com. And you can ask us anything. We're here to, it doesn't even have to be financial. We'll guide you through your relationships, whatever you want us to do.
You want him to ask you when winter's going to end for sure?
Yeah.
What's the final day of winter this year?
I have a quarter zip on for today's show.
I'm wearing a sweater. It's Easter winter.
It is Easter. It's almost April. It shouldn't be that way. I don't think it's going to be much longer.
Yeah.
But yes, a prolonged winter here in Central Arkansas. I don't know if it's cold where you're listening. We've actually got a question today from California.
A little bit later.
Yeah,
the weather's probably different there.
Yeah, probably so, depending on what end of the state she's in. But we're going to hear from Garrett in just a little while. But first up on the show, it's James from Little Rock, and it's right to the point. James writes, should I be worried about a housing crash in 2024? Short answer here, no. We don't think you should be worried about it. Now, we think the odds of it actually happening are very, very low. But even if it does, we don't think you should be worried about it. We're going to figure that out. But when you think about where we are in the housing market, certainly we've been through a whiplash of home values over the last couple of years. Right after COVID started to ease up in 2021, everybody was wanting to buy a house. Appraisals went off the charts, and especially on the coasts and in resort areas, you saw and are still seeing values really be inflated. Could some of those values go down? I think where they were a little bit unrealistic to start with, yes, I think that the values could come down. But when you think about where the housing market is, Janet, I don't really see a crisis or a crash coming. The last crash that we really experienced was in 2008, and we didn't have any of those variables in place.
You're right. And one of the things there in 2008 that a lot of people really, if they're not in this industry or in the housing industry, they're just not aware of, there was an accounting rule that was put in place that was really the cause of the 2008 crisis. And then once they changed that accounting rule, everything turned right around after that. But the other thing, Scott, you and I have both lived through much higher interest rates as far as mortgage rates. We've lived through higher interest rate environments than what we're in right now. And I think there's a recency bias, and I get it. I mean, on the house that we're in right now, we pay less than 3% on our interest on our mortgage because we refinanced it at a time when it made sense, you know, at a very low rate to do that. So that's taken a number of years off of the timeline that we would have been in that mortgage otherwise. And so I get it. When you've seen things south of 3 and you're seeing them where they are now, it feels like, oh my gosh, nobody's ever going to buy a house again. That's really not true, because I also remember when I made way less money because I was way younger and had less work experience. I remember paying 7 point something and being glad to get it, you know? And what did you have?
I had 8% on my first home in 1999. We actually got some historical numbers for you. If you take up through the decades, these are the average mortgage rates in the United States per decade going back to the 70s. And you'll see that we are definitely in the lowest we've been in history.
Yeah.
In the 70s, the average was 7.33. In the 80s, it was 12.9. Let that sink in for a minute.
Yeah.
In the 90s, it was 9.8. In the first decade of the 21st century, it was 8.15. And even as recently as the 2010s, it was 5.09.
Right.
And then since the 2020s, began that decade, 3.72. So by far, we're still in historically low to average mortgage rates. The recency bias is a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think that that lends into where we think the housing market is. It's really more of a supply issue than it is a demand issue. Because when you think about it, if you are a homeowner and you have one of those 3.7% mortgages, you're not in a big hurry to get out of it, right? If you don't have to relocate and you don't have to move, you're probably not going to. But a lot of people still are. There's a lot of relocation going on. There's a lot of upgrades. And I think for the most part, this is a Scott take, okay? So this is not going to be backed with any data.
Not the official information.
the longer it stays at a specific, you know, as longer it stays around 6 or 7, the more people get used to it and the more people don't want to delay taking that next step of home ownership. Because
your recency bias changes.
Right.
That's what happens. Here's the deal. When you talk about they don't want to delay that home ownership, life is moving forward. Mm-hmm. You know, you've added another kid to the family or, you know, whatever the case may be, these stages of life, maybe you need to upsize, maybe you need to downsize, whatever the case is, life continues to change while you wait for the mortgage rate to change. And so you've just got to make a decision. And I'm not telling anybody, go out and get the house today. But I am telling you, don't let life pass you by while you wait for that perfect moment, because you're not going to have the perfect moment.
Yeah, and over time, the value of that home is going to continue to go up too, right? So you're waiting for a mortgage rate to go down. Meantime, the value of the home is going up. Now, again, to James's question, you know, there could be a bubble in some areas. As we talked about at the beginning of answering this question, in areas where it really went up too fast, too quickly, I think you're going to see some of those values go back down, but I don't think it warrants thinking it's going to be a crash. But the bigger issue here, when James says, should I be worried about a housing crash, it brings us back to something we say time and time again on the Get Ready for the Future show. It is not about the economy. Mm-hmm. It is about your economy. So, James, are you prepared if there is a housing crash? Because that's really the bigger question here. Where are you? Do you have, because if you're still working and you have got a mortgage payment that is very workable and you have the margin between your income and expenses that you're not concerned, even maybe if there is a little bit of a loss of income between, if you're married and one of the spouses loses their job, can you continue to make that mortgage payment? Then you can ride out any storm. It's kind of like, Janet, when we talk about selling stocks when they're down. If you don't have to sell your house and a crash comes and you ride out that storm, we believe on the other end it's going to go back up.
I would agree. And Scott, you referenced the bubble and said we do believe there may be a little bit of that in some areas. But to be specific about what areas, we're not necessarily talking about geographic areas, but like the types of properties, mm-hmm. maybe vacation homes and resorts, that type of thing. There may be a little bit of a bubble there. And that's very different than a crash, though, still. It's a very different verbiage. And I think about, Scott, after we were all boarded up in our houses, basically, for a few weeks that felt like a few years back with COVID, and then a lot of people began to work from home, and still many have not gone back necessarily 5 days a week. They're back in the office, but a lot of people still have times when they work from home. And so the travel industry has really benefited from when people were able to leave home again. And now if you're working from home and living at home, you know, then there's this stronger desire, I think, to go and spend time away from that house. Mm-hmm. So, we haven't seen a bubble for sure, but that's a possibility just because we've had a shift in our habits.
Yeah. And one final note for James here and for everyone else listening, I think another way to ride out that storm, if it does happen, is it kind of brings us back to an emergency fund. You know, we talk about that all the time, having living expenses stacked up. If you do lose your job, that's part of your living expenses is that mortgage. So it gives you 3 to 6 months to find that next job, and then you don't have to sell your house if the values are down. And again, one final note about that. I think that another reason we might be concerned that there might be a housing crash would be if unemployment was high. That was another thing that happened. It kind of went hand in hand with the banking crisis in 2008, but we went into a recession really quickly. 2008's unemployment rate averaged 7.3%. By 2009, it was 9.9%. Mm-hmm. Guess what it is today? 3.9%. You don't have a recession. You don't have a bad economy when you have an unemployment rate that low. James, thanks for the question. If you have questions for us, get them to us. The number is 501-381-5228. You can call and leave a voicemail or text them to us. You can also send an email. Send it to show at getreadyforthefuture.com. For our next question, we go to a voicemail all the way from California.
Hi, my name is Gurep. I'm from California, and I inherited $350,000 all in checking accounts, and I wasn't sure if I have to pay taxes because I'm doing my taxes right now. Thank you.
Gurep, thank you very much, and thanks for watching or listening, however you get the Get Ready for the Future show in California. So, Janet, inheritance in bank accounts,
yeah,
we don't really see a taxation issue there.
No, we don't. And I will say we did a little bit of research just to make sure about the state of California specifically. But on a federal level, there is no inheritance tax when you receive money as you did, because it should have already been paid by the estate. Let me clarify. The estate should have paid what are called estate taxes. So there is no inheritance tax when you receive that money because it should have already been taken care of at that point. On a state level, California does the same thing as the feds do. There's no state level of an inheritance tax. The only question that we would have for you, Garrett, is the decedent, did that person live also in California or potentially a different state? If they lived in a different state, then there might be a nuance that you need to check on that other state, because you might fall under their state's rules on the inheritance tax. So there may be something there, but from what we see, definitely in California, you don't have that obligation, and on a federal level, you don't have that obligation.
Now, here's our next question for you, Gurep, is what now? Let's assume that the taxes have been handled. You have $350,000, and it is sitting either in cash or in potentially CDs. It said all in checking accounts, so likely all in cash. What are you going to do with that? And if you're in that same boat listening or watching today, that you have some lump sum, either inheritance or something that you've sold a house and you didn't buy a house, I mean, however you achieved or received a lump sum of dollars, you really have to spend some time planning and thinking about what the best use of those dollars are. And we know, without even knowing Gurep, we know statistically that it's going to be real enticing to do something for yourself, and that's okay. But don't get carried away with it, because you have to kind of figure out where your financial needs and where your financial goals are, because this is an opportunity to accelerate the timeline on those goals.
It absolutely is. And we're going to go through some bullet points, and I would just say to pay attention to the sequencing of this. We're not just randomly saying them in any order. This is the sequence that I would think through what you need to do with these dollars. So the first thing that you need to ask yourself is, do you want to do any charitable giving with the money that you've received? If you are charitably inclined, then I would do that first and then look at what the remaining amount is that you have left. Beyond that, you want to focus on getting just a foundational level of an emergency fund if you don't already have that. And we're just talking about a couple of thousand dollars. Obviously, you'll be able to satisfy that with this money, but for other people listening who may be in a different situation, that $2,000 level is what we're looking at first. And then beyond that, you want to focus on all the non-mortgage debt. So if you have a vehicle payment, if you have student loans, if you have credit cards, anything like that, get that taken care of, because what that's going to turn around and do is free up your monthly cash flow. Assuming that you're working for an income somewhere, or even if you're not working, if you were retired, that monthly cash flow is being utilized to pay these debts right now. So if you can pay those off, you're going to save interest money, but also, more importantly to me, you're going to free up that cash flow for yourself. And then beyond that, you would circle back to savings and then focus on, Gurep, we don't really know your age and proximity to retirement, but if you're still preparing for retirement, so after you get that savings shored up to have enough to have like 6 months of expenses covered, then the next thing is to really focus on your retirement and being able to invest for that. If you have kids that you need to plan for college education, that's the next step. And then paying off the house. And then beyond that, just building wealth and giving. So just take some time, Gurep, to go through those things that we've just listed and prioritize, you know, what's your situation and what can you utilize with those dollars. One thing that I want to say specifically not to do, we see this a lot of times, particularly with females, and is most often with a widow, when they receive life insurance money, it is very common to go, I want to pay off the house because it's a security thing. Hmm. Well, we would, in most situations, instead of encouraging you to take, let's say, $300,000 and pay off the house, what if you took that $300,000 and established it investment-wise so that you could have an income stream, and the income stream makes the house payment for you, but then after that house payment is done, you still have this pool of money for you, as opposed to it's just gone. So just be cautious about putting all of this towards one significant need.
Yeah, and I think if, as a more general way of looking at this, and you gave very detailed action points in the order of which, but if you just think about it in terms of what are my immediate needs, mm-hmm. what are my intermediate needs, and what are my long-term needs, that kind of helps you decide how you need to divide that $350,000 into maybe different buckets or tranches, because, you know, depending on your proximity to retirement, those may be different dollar amounts. But I do think at the end of the day, how to figure that out, the best way to do that is to work with the financial advisor that does financial planning. You know, here at Gen Wealth, we do retirement income planning. We've talked about it many times on this show that retirement is an income problem. And we're trying to, as we mentioned at the top of the show, help people discover, protect, and share true financial independence. That's a date in the future for you. That's a planned date in the future. It should be for everyone. It's not always a priority, and it doesn't happen for everyone, but if you plan, it can. And it doesn't mean you retire. It just means you are able to. You are now at the point in life when you're financially independent, able to use your assets for income to last for the rest of your life. And that's what we're really trying to achieve here. But all those other tentacles come from that, right? Because you have to, as you mentioned, the cash flow, the margin, right. Those things have to be there to be able to contribute to your financial independence. Gorette, thanks very much for the question. We're going to name it the question of the week. And you can get a Get Ready for the Future show Tumblr for being named the question of the week. And we just need you to email us to claim it. Just send the email to show@getreadyforthefuture.com. And we probably should give her something a little extra because, to our knowledge, that's the farthest away geographically that we have received a question on the show.
We've known that we've had listeners in foreign countries before, but we've never gotten a question from that far away. So that's awesome. Thanks, Gorette.
Yep. Our next question comes from Tracy in Maumelle. I'm 62 with $1 million in a 401k. Should I convert $100,000 a year to a Roth IRA to avoid RMDs? Tracy, I don't think so. I think that's going to create a headache, and we're going to walk through that. Generally, let's set the table here, Janet. We love the idea of getting as much money into Roth IRAs as you can. Okay, so that's a good priority. It's a good thought process. I think the thing that you have to be careful of is how much you get there, and I think trying to get it all in there at this stage in your life, mm-hmm. at 62 years old, just for the purpose of avoiding RMDs, is probably a little misguided.
Yeah, I would completely agree. Tracy, we think that people talk about RMDs like they are the devil, and they are not. The point is, the required minimum distribution is what that stands for. The required minimum distribution causes X amount of money, whatever it might be, to be taxable. Okay, but if you convert $100,000, guess what? That amount is more than the minimum, and it's taxable to you in the year that you convert it. And so while Scott said, you know, we like to have as much Roth money as we possibly can, this is a slow and steady wins the race approach rather than how much can I push over there, especially in your 60s, because we lose the greatest opportunity of the Roth, I believe, is the time value of money. The longer that you have the Roth, the more advantageous it is. And so we wouldn't even be opposed to, you know, still converting some, but $100,000 is going to eat you on taxes. Mm-hmm. It's a very significant tax impact, Scott.
Yeah, and it could be, you know, again, just working through how that works for you, Tracy, is every dollar you convert while you're working is stacked on top of your employment income. So if you're married and you have a joint household and your income is into the six figures, it could cause you, if you converted too much, to leap into a higher federal tax bracket. And that could that would be obviously something you didn't want to do because your RMD, the tax bracket that you are taxed at when you have to take that money out of the IRA, is likely, at least statistically, to be lower because people mm-hmm. usually live on less income in retirement than they make in their work life. Not always, but most of the time. So if you think about just the math of that, you're going to pay more tax now than you would if you waited and took an RMD. So what we like to do is when people are getting close to retirement and they know in that first year that their income is going to drop off significantly, that may be the time to really earmark some IRA dollars for conversion into a Roth. But again, maybe not $100,000. It may be smaller increments. Because again, the idea here is great. We want to get it in there. I don't think just to avoid RMDs is the focus here or the priority.
I mean, really, you've got, since at your age, you don't have to take RMDs until you're 75. So you have 13 years before we even have to take any RMDs. And I think there's a little bit of a fallacy in the thought the concept here of converting $100,000 a year and in 10 years you'll be done with it. And you're not the only person to think that, but here's the deal. If you have $1 million and you convert $100,000, okay, we moved that $100,000 over, we paid taxes on it. What happened with the $900,000 in the next year before we convert another $100,000? The probability is that it had some growth. And even if it grew at 10%, then that account value is not 900, it's back to 990. You're back almost where you started. And so I don't think that it's feasible really with the amount of money that we're talking about, even if you converted $100,000 a year, unless you just turn off the growth, which I do not recommend. Unless you turn off the growth, you're not going to get this converted in a decade. You're still going to have some degree of required minimum distributions. And one of the other things I think about that people don't consider is the advantages that you have. And frankly, this can start at 70 and a half. You don't have to wait until your required minimum distribution age, but you can make contributions called qualified charitable distributions that go directly from your IRA to a 501c3 charitable organization. And there are some tax advantages to doing that. There are some Medicare premium advantages to doing that. So that's a possibility that without these IRA dollars, you would not be able to do.
And I think it's important too for Tracy to ask herself and anybody else who may be thinking along these lines, what is your goal with this money? You saved it for a lifetime. Is it just to avoid taking it out? Because when I hear somebody ask, hey, I want to avoid RMDs, it seems to me you're positioning that money as just in case. That's your just in case retirement. I'm going to try to live on my Social Security. Maybe there's a pension, whatever other income sources you have. And that's just out there in case of an emergency or in case I want to do something with it. I want to encourage you to think about creating a monthly retirement income plan. When you think about taking that out systematically over the course of your retirement, you have a different mindset. You know, there's stats out there, there's data out there that we've quoted here before that shows retirees are more at peace when they take their money out over a monthly basis than taking a little bit here and a little bit there whenever they really feel like using some.
It makes people, there's a completely different psychology. It makes people feel like they have to ask permission and know every single time, is it okay, like mathematically, is it okay if I take out $20,000, you know, for the next year? Is that okay if I do that? Where if they divided that $20,000 up throughout the year to supplement whatever other income, then it just feels very different psychologically.
Yeah. And we have different clients that sometimes need that money, right? They need some of their life savings to add to their income just to be able to pay expenses. And then we have some clients who don't need it, but we work through that retirement income plan, build that for them, and show them what they can potentially take out. And here's the other part of that. Just because you take it out doesn't mean you have to spend it. You can get it out, pay the taxes on it, help your next generation who's going to inherit that IRA, because as we've talked about before here, the inherited IRA rules have changed. So when you pass those IRA dollars on to your children, they're going to have to take it out in 10 years, which could create a big tax bomb for them. So creating a systematic withdrawal from your IRA, making sure you don't get into a higher tax bracket, but taking those dollars out on a monthly basis, either using them to spend on your retirement or stacking them away in savings for a next lump sum purchase, or maybe even reinvesting those dollars. There's all sorts of advantages to doing all three of those things that takes your focus off of, I'm going to park this money. I don't want to take it out because I'm going to have to pay the taxes on it. I think you got to kind of get out of your head on some of those
things. Yeah, I would completely agree. I would say that this, I know this feels like our answer all the time, but honestly, it is our answer all the time. I think this goes back to a need for planning that you have done an amazing job to, in your lifetime, accumulate seven figures in your 401k. Congratulations. That's amazing. And I'm super proud of you for the discipline that it took through the years to do that. You could have done a lot of other things with those dollars, but you contributed them towards your retirement. It's a little bit easier to be successful in contributions than it is in distributions, because you put the money in, your employer does a match of whatever type, and given time, it just grows. But then when you get ready to distribute, there are all these little nuances. We talked about a very small number of them, but there are a lot of nuances to deal with in retirement income planning. And Scott, as you mentioned at the top of the show, this is what we do. It's retirement income planning. All the other things that we do, like coaching people on their debt, et cetera, that all ties back into retirement income. You don't need as much income if you have less debt, but it's all circled around that income. So if Tracy needs a financial coach to walk through this, what does she do?
Yeah, I think the easiest thing is to just call us, Tracy, especially in Maumelle. We've got offices all over Central Arkansas in Conway, Little Rock, Bryant. We're also in El Dorado, Northwest Louisiana, Hot Springs. There is a GenWealth advisor ready to walk through that process with you. You can just reach out by calling toll-free 866-653-PLAN. That's 866-653-7526, and begin walking through the GenWealth Ready to Retire process. We cover all the bases and create a retirement income plan customized for you. Because, again, to go back to, you know, Janet said we talk about the plan all the time, but really, if you look at Tracy's question, I'm 62 with $1 million in a 401k. Without a plan, that's what you got, right?
Yeah.
I got $1 million.
Yeah.
But what does that
now
mean?
What?
What does that mean in terms of real monthly income for you in retirement with that income plan to grow over time with inflation-adjusted raises for you? Find out by going through the GenWealth Ready to Retire process. Again, the number is 866-653-PLAN. Our final question of the show today is from Ashley. She sends in a text message. I work in state government, and I get a pension that covers 60% of my salary after I leave at age 56. Is it okay to not invest more, as that would exceed my retirement needs? Not really, Ashley. I don't think that's a good idea, and we're going to walk through why.
Yeah, so I'm going to use my mom as an example on this. She was a public school teacher in Arkansas, which means she also had a pension and she also has Social Security. And if that were all that she had, there would be times when we would need to help my mom. There are not times when we need to help her, because she and my dad made very wise decisions to set aside money along the way to be able to supplement her retirement. But we just recently talked about the money from the pension and from Social Security covers everything that she needs on a monthly basis. And Ashley, I think that's really what you're thinking about. But it doesn't cover the ancillary things. It doesn't cover property taxes. It doesn't cover, you know, the big insurance bills that you get from time to time on property or on vehicles, et cetera. It doesn't cover any ancillary medical expenses. It doesn't cover vacations, you know, going to Disney with the grandkids, whatever it might be. The other things in life that are outside of your month-in, month-out expenses. And frankly, even to just have a, you know, we kind of make fun of it a little bit, but a just-in-case fund, yeah, you know,
right,
to have a pool of assets that are just in case I need them. And we don't want people living a just-in-case retirement. When we talk about that, it's when they have money sitting over here and they're scared to use it. If you don't need to use it, that's fine. But you want to have the ability to be flexible. Flexibility, I think, is the key word that I would tell you that, Ashley, you would be missing if you just retire with a pension and then when you're old enough, Social Security.
Yeah, and the other big thing here is inflation.
You know,
I think about the inflation factor. You know, with state government, more than likely you have a cost of living adjustment on that pension, which is great because most pensions don't, but it is probably not going to be enough to keep up with inflation. Just think about it. It's a set amount. You know, even Social Security gets... their cost of living is judged based on what the inflation is for at least a part of the previous year. With state government, it's going to be set, and it can change for the worse because we see a lot of that in a legislative risk of going down rather than up. But let's say it's 3%, which is typical for a government pension. You get a 3% cost of living adjustment raise every year on your pension. Well, what about when inflation is more than that? You know, the historical average is a tad over that. And certainly in the last 3 or 4 years, we've experienced inflation that was almost double that, if not more than double that. So I think you have to have additional assets to give yourself a cost of living raise that is a true cost of living raise rather than just on the pension. And, you know, the other thing, too, for me, she talks about her retirement needs. I would think, Ashley, you would think about your retirement in two pieces, your retirement needs and your retirement desires. Mm-hmm. You don't really want, I don't think, to live on a fixed, true fixed income. In retirement, you want to have some additional assets that can provide you additional income so that you can do the things that you want to do. Again, we're not talking about, whew, I retired. We're talking about financial independence.
Right.
We're talking about the ability to really do what you want. We break it down on the needs part. That really buys your dignity. Your retirement needs will be covered with your pension and Social Security, likely. You'll be able to have dignity in retirement, but true independence comes from that next tier of income.
So let the pension cover your required income, and let's talk beyond that about your desired income, and that's why we would supplement. One of the things that I would also consider, and this is not something that you have to do, but I do think it's important for you to answer the question, is there any money that you want to leave to your heirs? Because a pension is not going to do that. If you're married, you can set it up so that there is a spousal benefit, but it's not going to go to the next generation. And even if you don't leave them a lot, do you want to leave them anything? And that's just something that we think is important to think through. But also, since I mentioned a spousal benefit, that's another thing to think about in just planning for your retirement income. Do you have a spouse? If so, do they have a pension? Are you going to need to supplement, you know, from that standpoint as well? Because if you have a pension and they don't, then when you pass away, what they receive of your pension is probably a decreased benefit. And if not, then you compromise to get a lower benefit on the front end. So there's a lot of scenarios there to think through, Scott, in that planning process.
Yeah, and ultimately it comes back to what we talked a little bit about with Tracy, that retirement is essentially an income problem, not an asset problem. And you may say, well, Ashley, just say, well, then I don't worry about having assets. No, you have to have the assets to make the income, but that is your focus. Coming in and making a plan that shows you on paper, on purpose, what your monthly income starts at in day one of retirement and how it grows over time, which again can really only be achieved through the additional assets with the cost of living adjustments for true inflation. I think that's where you get to really visualize the end of your work life and the beginning of your financial independence and see what it looks like moving forward and then back into what kind of assets do I need and what kind of contribution rate do I need to achieve that asset level. You heard the final bell in the background. Janet, we'll start with you on the final thoughts.
75% of the questions that we had today really dealt with, even though they weren't necessarily worded this way, they really dealt with the question of retirement income. And Scott, I'll say anybody out there who's listening to us, if you make it to retirement, you've got to answer the question of retirement income. And so we believe that it's important to put that plan on paper on purpose so that you know and you can have peace of mind when you take a distribution. It's okay because the written plan says it's okay. So I'm not using emotion to take more money than I should, and I'm going to regret it later. And I'm also not using emotion, the fear, to take less money than I can and then regret not living life later.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what the Gen Wealth Ready to Retire process is all about. My final thought would be, we talked about it a moment ago, but if you think about it, you know, we deal with investment strategy. That is a big component to someone's financial independence, but it's not the only component. And it's not the chief component. Income planning is the chief component. So if you work with an advisor that all he talks about is investments, all he talks about is the next stock tip, or you need this product or that product, it should be about the plan. And if you don't have a plan, we would encourage you to reach out to us at 866-653-PLAN. 866-653-7526 to build a retirement income plan for you and your spouse. If you have one, it's the GenWealth Ready to Retire process. Begin walking through it today. You can also, if you don't feel like calling us, you can send us an email. Just send us to show@getreadyforthefuture.com. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks for being with us on the Get Ready for the Future show. If you have questions, Arkansas, California, Utah, New York, wherever you are, get them to us. Call or text them in, 501-381-5228 or show@getreadyforthefuture.com. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Get Ready for the Future show. If you enjoy hearing from the GenWealth team every week, make sure and subscribe to the podcast. And you can always find us on social media. Search for GenWealth Financial Advisors on Facebook or on Twitter at GenWealthFA. The GenWealth Financial Team is available to you 24/7 at info@getreadyforthefuture.com or call our offices at 866-653-PLAN. That's 866-653-7526. You should personally consult a financial advisor before making any investment, and no strategy can assure success. Securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC. Investment advice offered through Independent Advisor Alliance. Independent Advisor Alliance and GenWealth Financial Advisors are separate entities from LPL Financial.